Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We are joined by our friend Andrea Picciotti-Bea today to talk about legal justice issues pertaining to especially First Amendment rights, our freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, freedom of worship, and expression of our religion. And this week, we're talking about how the Department of Government Efficiency has been taking a wrecking ball to USAID. It's been finding numerous examples of funds being spent on frivolous efforts. It's important to remember the work the Church does to aid those in need. And so we want to provide some true Catholic context to understanding where the law of charity applies and where civil obedience applies, so how we render to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God. From there, we continue that conversation by talking about a critique of reason, or at least a critique of the critique of pure reason. Immanuel Kant, he is one of the most difficult philosophers to read, and I wouldn't encourage any of you to pick up a critique of pure reason right now, but what I would encourage you to do is at least get to know some of the thoughts that Kant put forth. I want to talk about the impact of his work and his thought on the way people conduct themselves today, and particularly Kant's system of reasoning didn't allow for a faith that was congruent with reasonable inquiry. He seemed to believe that faith had to be this kind of credulity, if you will, and morality had to be bound by nothing more than objective, reasonable duty, and so revelation had no part to play in this. This is problematic, and if faith is nothing more than a subjective experience, then there is no objective reality to the inquiry and experience of faith. And the Church has always stood against this. So we're going to talk about Kant's ideas, how they impact our society today, and then after that we're going to talk about what the Church actually teaches of where you and I ought to stand on this issue, that faith and reason are the two wings with which the intellect ascends to the contemplation of truth. And finally, we speak with my friend Dr. David Anders. This is National Marriage Week, and we want to talk about how Dr. David Anders' marriage was saved by the gift of the Catholic faith and the Catholic Church. And we talk about all of this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, February 12th. It's the Feast of St. Benedict of Anway. And today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at avemariafunds.com. President Trump says he spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin and they will immediately start negotiations related to ending the Russian-Ukrainian war. In a post on Truth Social, Trump said the call was highly productive and they also discussed the Middle East and AI, among other things. The president said Putin agreed with him that the violence in the war needs to stop. He said the two will work closely together on negotiations, including visiting each other's nations at some point. Trump also spoke to Ukrainian President Zelensky, informing him he spoke with Putin. The Senate is expected to hold a confirmation vote for Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s cabinet nomination tomorrow. The chamber voted 53-47 along party lines to end debate on the nomination. The final vote is likely to take place on Thursday. Democrats have pointed to past comments made by Kennedy Jr. related to his criticism of vaccines. Inflation rose more than anticipated last month. January's Consumer Price Index, which measures the cost in goods and services, increased by 0.5% for the month. That was against expectations of 0.3%. It also pushed the yearly inflation rate to 3%, against projections of 2.9%. And Costco is the latest retailer to limit egg purchases. Grocery stores have been seeing empty shelves since late last year. Trader Joe's have also limited eggs to a dozen per customer per day. Costco customers will now be limited to 3 packages of eggs. Sam's Club also confirmed a 2-package limit. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Alex Peter. The Department of Government Efficiency has taken a wrecking ball to USAID. It has found numerous examples of funds being spent on frivolous efforts. It's important to remember the work the church does to aid those in need. We're joined by my friend, Andrew Pichotti-Bear, who is legal analyst for EWTN News and director of the Conscience Project. You can follow her work at conscience-project.org. Andrea, so great to speak with you. How are you?
I'm doing great, Marcus. Thanks. How are you doing?
I'm well, and I'm glad we're having this conversation because we want to be careful to not paint a picture as if what is being done is completely evil, but there is a Catholic narrative to all this. So let's paint that big picture narrative right now. Let's frame the question.
You know, I think, Marcus, a lot of what's going on these initial weeks of the second Trump administration is really kind of unimaginable. Mm. I mean, in many ways, really strong and sweeping efforts to undo some of the damage done by the Biden administration mm-hmm. with regard to individual freedoms, this basic concept of what it means to be human. And all of those are things that people of faith really need to rally behind. And so we've spoken in the past about kind of my love for many of the executive orders, but there is this kind of practical governance mm-hmm. issue. And in many ways, I think that there's a great cleaning of house that's going on within yeah. the federal government. But we also need to be very mindful and nuanced that there are really important initiatives that are done on behalf of the government through different agencies, and we don't want to be in a position where we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right?
Right.
And USAID is one of those particular agencies that's gotten kind of the scorn because of mismanagement and grants that are not furthering the interests of the United States, and yeah. in fact promoting harmful ideas. But there are very important programs, and it's important when we think about protecting persecuted Christians, the role that USAID has done, especially in Iraq and Syria.
Right. And those are the things that we ought to talk about, because in the heat or the waves, if you will, of all the news of what USAID has been funding that has anywhere from belittled to even compromised the influence or the position or at least even the reputation of the United States in different areas across the world, especially in terms of the spreading of communist ideologies, Marxist ideologies. But when you talk about, for example, furthering the cause of Christians and furthering the cause of their rights, right to life even, in areas in the Middle East, these are things we're not hearing too much about right now.
Well, and it's very interesting because in the prior administration, one of the most incredible steps that was taken was to pull assistance away from the United Nations mm-hmm. and put it through the USAID to work in collaboration with some of our incredible faith-based groups that were on the ground, mm-hmm. right? The Knights of Columbus was particularly important, both in shedding a light on the atrocities and the persecution of Christians in those regions, but also in building relationships with people on the ground to get the relief to the people that needed it. So relief wasn't going to the persecutors, but to the persecuted. And so it's a little bit of a disconnect. You'd hope that there would have been some more institutional memory mm-hmm. On how vital USAID has been, especially for persecuted Christians and other people persecuted because of their faith.
Right.
I'm hoping that this can be easily rectified, and I really do think that this is where the church, as an institution and different Catholic-run entities can go in and build partnership again with the Trump administration mm-hmm. in making sure that these necessary reforms don't sweep so broadly
yes.
as to cause greater injury and for the most vulnerable.
And that was the point that came to my mind as well, that right now the cleaning house is being done by painting with such broad strokes that we are running the risk of affecting the common good in the process. Now, a lot of good is being done. We don't want to negate that. A lot of good is being done. But we want to be careful, for example, when the vice president makes statements against the USCCB for their work through Catholic Charities and receiving grants and federal funding for migration and refugee programs. There's truth to the reality that Catholic Charities does, in fact, receive this federal funding, but we need to understand how that's being appropriated and utilized.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's another issue that if let's assume that we all realize that the United States has a legitimate right to have a clear immigration policy.
Yep.
At the same time, there's just the humanitarian response to the countless people that are suffering because of immigration into the country, right? Mm-hmm. Legal immigration. And we need to address that humanitarian crisis in a way that almost stabilizes people and returns them in a very orderly way back to their home countries.
Right.
And if they do qualify for asylum, and asylum is a very narrowly defined qualification, that they will not be sent back where, you know, they could be targeted and killed if their qualification for asylum to remain in the country is clear. I think that the very difficult thing and the reality, Marcus, is just under the Biden administration, everything was blurred,
yes.
Right? And there was such attacks on our borders. And we're going to be seeing, I think, you know, the kind of bad fruits of that neglect, especially when it comes to women and children and the vulnerabilities that we're seeing either through trafficking, human trafficking, sex trafficking. That happened, you know, on all of our watches.
Yep.
And we need to figure out how to help people to be able to recover from those abuses and get back to places of support in their own countries.
Yep. And I'm really glad you brought that up, Andrea. And we need to say it objectively that illegal immigration, and by that we mean the willful violation of civil laws pertaining to legal migration in the United States, if that is violated, illegal immigration in any circumstance isn't valid. However, there are legitimate circumstances of asylum and refugee status, and those distinctions need to be made. But once vetted, we can talk about a humanitarian response. But a humane response is, in fact, the returning of those who illegally immigrated into their countries of origin, and they can then seek legal channels if necessary. But no nation has the obligation of entertaining completely open borders and illegal immigration. And that's part of the conversation of the common good of the nation.
No, and actually, Marcus, I'd add it's part of the common good, the individual human flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
Many people who are in the United States illegally are very vulnerable because
yes.
of their illegal status. And that means that they can be taken advantage of at the workplace. If they have injuries, they don't have the same kind of coverage and protection that Americans residing here, either as citizens or permanent residents or with work permits have. And so it's almost creating a population that's particularly vulnerable.
Yes.
And that's not good for individuals. And also, like you mentioned before, Marcus, there's an orderly process. The process needs to be looked at to be able to function well, to be able to be streamlined so that there aren't years in which families, maybe that their marriages, legal marriages, legitimate marriages, and someone isn't able to come here, and families are separated because of that. So there's a lot that's broken in our system, but I don't think it means that we ignore the system.
Right.
Nor does it mean that we just kind of throw in the towel here.
Yeah.
I mean, our country is founded upon particularly robust immigration, but it has to be ordered, and that is good not only for the common good, for the immigrant themselves.
Yes, exactly. And as a closing thought, just for the sake of our listeners, we also need to acknowledge the United States, contrary to what narratives say, does not possess the harshest immigration laws in the world. That's factually not true. And so, you know, we can keep looking at these things and having these conversations. Andrea, thank you very much for making the time to speak with us.
No, it's always a pleasure, Marcus. Thank you.
My guest, Andrea Picciotti-Bea, legal analyst for EWTN News, director of the Conscience Project. We've been talking about the proper Catholic response to the issue of illegal immigration and the preservation of strong borders in the flourishing of the common good and individuals. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Hello, Steve Ray here. We're going to Normandy, France in November to celebrate the 80th anniversary of D-Day. We'll also be in Paris for the opening of the resurrected Notre Dame Cathedral. Join us on a pilgrimage of discovery through the saints and shrines of France. Catherine Laborier and the Miraculous Medal, St. Thérèse of Lisieux, the Incorrupt Body of Vincent de Paul, a dinner cruise through Paris on the Seine River, and so much more.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Before I begin talking about Immanuel Kant in this segment, I want to address something. We received a call during the segment we just had with Andrea Picciotti-Bea, and the call was to the effect that USAID was channeling funds. It was channeling funds to a myriad of recipients, and I don't think that the Department of Government Efficiency has gotten to the bottom of where all of the funding has gone. But some of these funds were going to groups that were persecuting Christians. And I'm going to reiterate what Andrea and I both said, which I believe the Catholic Church would affirm, which is that if the funding is going to anything remotely unjust, we ought to put a stop to it immediately. But in the process, like Andrea said earlier, we don't want to throw out babies with the bathwater, so we need to assess what can be done for good for human flourishing. But absolutely, if funding is being sent out by the United States using taxpayer funds for the sake of the detriment of human lives, Christian lives, then we need to seriously look at that and put a stop to it. Now, let's talk about Immanuel Kant. I mentioned during the open that few philosophers in history have been as difficult to read as him. But there's a reason why I want to talk about him today. It's the anniversary of his passing. And a lot of people don't think about Immanuel Kant. And it's not like we can't think about Kant. But we need to realize that he had a tremendous influence in how we have shaped our modern thought. It's alarming, actually. It's disastrous, to say the least. His style was abstract, very technical. It's actually frustrating to read for some people. But his real legacy is what he proposed, not how he wrote it. And it was really the redefinition of truth as a subjective experience. All of you know where I'm going with this, because you've encountered situations in modern culture that pushes this narrative. So yes, Kant's ideas might seem inaccessible, abstruse, and esoteric, but the consequences, we're seeing them today. He is at the origin of one of the most pervasive issues to our faith in the modern world. The belief that for you to have religion, it has to be a completely subjective experience, and it's never, ever going to appeal to objective truth, and that truth itself can be a subjective experience. Many people today seem to assume that faith is credulity. It has nothing to do with reason, no evidence, or reality itself. I recall teaching in high school and hearing students tell me things like, well, you know, there's no historical evidence for the person of Jesus Christ. There's a preponderance of evidence, but we take these narratives as presupposed reality because the modern narrative is religion is inscrutable, religion is irrational, and that's completely untrue. And this assumption can largely be traced to Kant. He sought to, quote-unquote, make room by his faith. He identified as a Christian by limiting the claims of reason upon the faith. And so the thing that made him most famous in philosophy was to declare that knowledge is not about conforming our minds to reality, but reality conforming to the structures of our minds. And you see the problem there immediately. For him, we don't perceive the world as is, we only perceive it as we see it, through the lens of our own subjective mental categories. And if that is the case, then by definition there is no actual objective truth. And so Kant was actually subtly but decisively shifting philosophy from objective truth to subjective experience. Now, he was one of the first people to do this, because virtually every influential philosopher that came before him sought to philosophize from the lens of objective truth. So the implications on religion, on the faith, they've been profound. Kant maintained, you and I cannot know with certainty whether God exists, because there is no objective truth. You make such a claim, then all of a sudden, nothing can be said with certainty. God's existence can't be certain. Whether you and I exist can't be certain. Whether we have free will, whether the human intellect even has true merit, whether there's an afterlife, whether Jesus really rose, nothing can be stated objectively, because there is no objective truth. So then he says, but because all of this is subjective, we must live as if these things are true, because morality depends on them being true. And you see the frivolity of that position. Because he would argue that his position is securing faith in the public sphere. Actually, what that does is undermines faith. Because he's saying there is no objective truth, but we have to act like all the teachings of Christianity are objectively true, because we need morality in society. Well, if you start with the premise of there is no objective truth, you've basically told people at some point Christianity isn't going to matter, because why bother about morality? All it does is it limits my way of acting and my way of functioning. If you and I believe in God not because he's real, but because belief in him is useful, then I'd rather believe in something else that makes me feel good. And that's given rise to a modern problem called moralistic therapeutic deism. We want a God that helps bolster our internal good feelings. We want to feel better. We want a grandfather in heaven, as Chesterton would say. Morality for Kant, then, is simply a law that we impose on ourselves so that we can talk about good living, but it's not an objective reality. There's no grounding in divine law. There's a kind of natural reality to it, but that's about it. And therefore, how binding can it be? And so by separating faith from reason, Kant started this kind of divorce, or at least I should say he brought it to a close, because Luther started it. The whole movement of Luther was that we needed philosophy to move away from the inquiry of the faith. Faith is not reasonable, it's purely voluntaristic. Kant finalized it by saying, yes, the whole thing is a subjective experience. And so Kant's influence actually runs deep in our present-day thought. Doctrine will always be sidelined in favor of personal experience. Objective revelations in the scriptures are always going to be cast aside in favor of the ebbs and flows of feelings. Sentiment over objective morality, because there is no objective truth, according to Kant. And so many religious educators today, rather than teaching the truth of the faith as an objective truth that warrants the inquiry of our reason, because reason can engage the faith, they present it as a kind of value system, one amongst many. Jesus Christ is nothing more than a good moral teacher on par with any other. That's a nice way to live. It's a nice pat on the back. But it's not necessarily true for everyone. And so the adage, what's true for you is true for you, but not true for me. My truth is my truth, your truth is your truth. This is not just a watered-down version of Christianity. Kant paved the way for the religious and moral relativism that we see in the modern sphere today. He wasn't the only one, obviously, but he had a tremendous influence. Kant's way of viewing faith strips it of the supernatural reality, because God is objective. He strips it of the historical reality, because historicity of Christianity is in fact an objective truth. And that's why Kant's version of Christianity will fail to inspire, fail to convert, and fail to transform society. Why should any of us embrace a religion that's preference and nothing else, that's based on subjective experience and nothing else? In the end, this way of thinking, it's a retreat. It diminishes God's gift to us of reason. And really, Kant was trying to respond to modern science, and he believed that faith couldn't compete with truth because science is truth. And so it has to be relegated to the realm of personal subjective belief. And this was a self-defeating premise, because the scientific revolution, well, truly speaking, even the growth of science, the initial outburst of science, completely owes its impetus to the Catholic Church. And the pursuit of the natural science was meant to illuminate the great expansive reality of God's created order. Take the Christian order out of the public sphere and even out of science, and science becomes its own defeat. So later thinkers followed his lead. They went even further. Religious belief is a mere myth. Psychology, social convention, all of these things can be a kind of religion. And so the scientific worldview that Kant tried to accommodate has revised itself. There's nothing true right now except what you can see under a microscope. So these are some of Kant's words. I had to deny knowledge in order to make room for faith. You see how dangerous that is. The death of dogma is the birth of morality. Religion is the recognition of all our duties as divine commands. There's nothing objective about it, just we are commanded and so do it. Faith is the free acceptance of that which we are not in a position to know. The Catholic Church has always taught faith and reason are not opposed. They are complementary ways of knowing the truth. This belief is deeply rooted in Scripture and all of the teachings of the Church. John Paul II, Fides et Ratio, this is in 1998, opens by saying, faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of truth. Pope Benedict XVI, in Caritas in Veritate, says reason, in order to be totally itself, needs faith. So my friends, don't shy away from utilizing the full expanse of your reason in your inquiry of the faith. And let the faith and the grace of God illuminate and elevate your reason to the contemplation of truth. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Today's programming on 990 WDEO is brought to you in part by Give 'Em Our Day sponsor, Bulldog Catholic at the University of Minnesota Duluth with Father Mike Schmitz. Over the last 20 years, Bulldog Catholic has grown beyond the borders of Duluth through Father Mike's collaboration with Ascension on projects like the Bible in a Year podcast and his Ascension Presents videos. Their goal is to do their best to make sure every person involved with Bulldog Catholic, both local and national, feels seen, known, and loved. Learn more at bulldogcatholic.org.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
What makes an act moral or immoral? The Catechism of the Catholic Church lays out specific criteria for us to follow. When he acts deliberately, man is, so to speak, the father of his acts. Acts freely chosen can be morally evaluated as either good or evil. The sources on which the morality of an act are determined are three. 1, the object chosen. 2, the intent of the act. 3, the circumstances surrounding the act. To be moral, the object of the act itself must be good and the intention pure. The circumstances are secondary to the first two criteria. They can increase or diminish the morality of the act. For instance, stealing a candy bar is wrong, but far less evil than robbing a bank. Intent and circumstance, however, cannot change the moral quality of the act itself. The end does not justify the means. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. This week is National Marriage Week. The theme is marriage, source of hope, spring of renewal. There was a time when Dr. David Andis's marriage was neither. He shares his story with us and how the church helped him rediscover the meaning of marriage. Dr. David Andis is a Catholic catechist, speaker, and writer. He lives in Birmingham, Alabama, and he hosts the daily call-in program, EWTN radio program, called Call to Communion. David, it is so great to speak with you again. How are you?
Marcus, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. It's good to hear your voice.
Likewise. I always enjoy it when you and I get to connect. And this isn't like a lot of the other times that you and I connect. I'm asking you to bare your soul for our listeners here. Your story about how the Catholic faith and its teaching on marriage and the family saved your own marriage is gut-wrenching, but it's such a poignant story and pertinent to this week's theme.
Well, I appreciate the invitation to share. So, you know, my story is that I did not grow up a Catholic. I did grow up in a Christian family that had a very strong understanding that marriage was permanent,
mm-hmm.
and there were certain things that you couldn't do outside of marriage that you could do in marriage. But I wasn't given a really good concept of marriage as a vocation. I mean, even though I understood that it was a God-ordained institution and that it had rules that surrounded it, and one of them was you never get divorced, you don't leave your wife.
Yeah.
I was committed to those principles, but I didn't really have the idea that you know, sort of beyond a kind of home base from which to branch out and do the other things in life that were what I was about, that marriage had a lot of intrinsic meaning beyond that. And, I never heard the message, for example, that the primary end of marriage is the procreation of children at all. I mean, everybody I knew who was married had children. I took it for granted that I would have children and that they had to be loved and cared for, but no one ever told me that was the function of marriage as such.
Right.
All right. And I certainly had never heard the message that marriage was a sacrament. That was something that Protestants did not believe at all.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, lived in a certain kind of way that marriage is actually a means of grace and a means of making Christ present in the world, right? And that the community of the family was where I was to orient, you know, all of my energies and my virtues. And then the doctrine of salvation that I grew up with taught me that, yes, virtue was important and morality was important, but, you know, everybody's totally depraved.
Yes.
You've heard of the doctrine of total depravity.
Oh, yeah.
And so everything you do is sinful, and you're saved by faith alone. And even though I knew Protestants that had great virtues, I was not one of them, and I wasn't given a moral theology that really encouraged me to develop virtue, or explain to me how you go about doing that. Even if you told me, okay, you need to develop habits of justice and chastity and fidelity and fortitude, I wouldn't have known how to go about it, you know?
Yeah.
There's no instruction on that. So the long story short is that when I came back to the practice of my Protestant faith as a young man, I had some high ideals, some wrong ideas, and a real lack of virtue in my life. I was an immature person with a kind of, I'd say romantic ideas about what marriage looked like, and naive grasp of the power of conversion to carry you through trials and troubles, you know, because I'd had a conversion experience and I knew something about the Bible. I thought that qualified me, that I had all that I needed to be a good husband, a good father. And the woman that I married, we got married very young, age 21, was equally naive, but even less formed in the Christian faith than I was, and equally less formed and equally unformed in virtue. So when the normal stresses of marital life began to weigh upon us, in particular the stresses associated with family life and children, and I was at that time in seminary and then later in PhD studies, where I had put pretty much 99% of my efforts.
Right.
Because, see, I didn't think of marriage as such as the vocation. You know, I thought of theology and seminary and the Christian ministry that I would do as my vocation. I began to feel the tension between my professional life and my family life, and I didn't have a good way of resolving that tension or even process it or think about it. And so, of course, you know, mutual recrimination, mutual resentments, hard feelings began to build up. And there's a secular marriage researcher named John Gottman who talks about, I think he calls it the four horsemen of the apocalypse for marriage. And if I could remember them, it goes something like this. It's, disagreement is not a problem because everybody disagrees. But disagreement turns into resentment, which turns into contempt, which turns into stonewalling, which is emotional removal from the relationship, and that presages divorce very, very reliably. And I can tell you, we went through all those stages of relational breakdown where disagreement turned into acrimony and accusation and resentment.
Yeah.
Eventually contempt, and finally just emotional breakdown, and so that we were two people living in the same home but utterly alienated from one another. And about that time, my theological studies had taken me right out of Protestantism and had brought me to the cusp of the Catholic faith. And for reasons that were purely academic, I mean, I literally read my way out of Protestantism, and I read my way into the Catholic tradition. But somewhere along the line, it also occurred to me, hey, you know what began as an academic interest actually offers something of a solution to my moral problem. And it was a strange realization for me to see that you know, just the purely theological, the purely theoretical encounter with Catholicism suddenly loomed before me as a solution to an existential crisis.
Right.
And so I approached my wife and said, I think I want to become Catholic. And she was furious at me. It did not evoke a good response in her. She was not excited, and because, see, I had spent years acquiring degrees with the expectation that I would be a seminary professor or a college professor at a Protestant institution. So not only did she resent me for pulling away from her, but here I had spent all this time and all this money and all this effort and all these years acquiring degrees for a career path that I was threatening to blow up. It seemed to her to just be one more whim, some selfish indulgence on David's part that was heedless of her needs or those of the families, and threatened to do the family great harm. So my interest in Catholicism was not received well by her at all. Of course, that's not how I conceived it. I thought of it as a genuine attempt to reform my moral life and my spiritual life in order to become a better husband and better father, but that was not, it wasn't received that way. And I did eventually go ahead and become Catholic without her. And we went through several very hard years of not only a broken down marriage, but a mixed marriage where I was a Catholic and she was not a Catholic, not a practicing Catholic. But eventually, you know, all my efforts to persuade her were fruitless. And you know, and today when guys call me on the radio and they're like, I want to become Catholic and my wife doesn't, you know, is there some, you know, lock solid argument I could bring to convince her to become Catholic? I'm like, that is not the way to do this, man. Trust me.
I've heard you say that.
Eventually what happened is I was pouring my heart and soul out to a priest in confession. It was Father Angelus Shaughnessy, of happy memory, who was resident for a while with the Friars at EWTN. And he was just a very compassionate and holy man. And I got this intuition that I couldn't reach my wife, but maybe he could. And my wife had grown up Catholic, but had left the church pretty much after confirmation as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to her and I said, you know, would you consider going to confession to Father Angelus? And she said, not in your life. That's the craziest thing you've ever said to me. No way. Go away. Don't even talk to me again. That's a terrible idea. No. And I don't know how I got the gumption to do this, but I came back and said, well, why don't you try it? And here comes the music. I'll tell you the rest of the story when we get back.
Our guest, Dr. David Andes, he's sharing the story of how the Catholic faith and really the theological teaching of the Church pertaining to the sacrament and covenant of marriage and the family transformed his life. It's National Marriage Week, and we are recounting this story as one of many testimonies. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Catholic Charities of Shiawassee and Genesee counties have been providing health and creating hope since 1941. It's the generosity of donors that allows them to provide necessary services such as their warming center, which provides refuge and comfort to thousands in our community. They also offer hot meals in their soup kitchens and help families make ends meet in their community closet. Even the smallest donation makes a meaningful difference. Join us in their mission by giving a donation at CatholicCharitiesFlint.org.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Italy aficionado Teresa Tomeo's newest book is now out on the Ave Maria online store. In Italy's shrines and wonders, Teresa Tomeo provides how best to navigate the most popular sites, best routes, and how the best to soak in all the beauty Italy has to offer. She also shares the most inspiring journeys to make your Italy excursion utterly unforgettable. Italy's shrines and wonders from Catholic Connections Teresa Tomeo can be purchased at avemariaradio.net.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, weekdays on Ave Maria Radio.
I encourage you to look at a report that came out several years ago by Americans United for Life. It's called Unsafe. And this idea is something else that has been pushed out there by the media and by Planned Parenthood and other pro-abortion organizations, that there are all these safety measures that were put into place when Roe versus Wade became legal. But as Father Frank Pavone and so many others say, abortion never, ever, ever changed, really. It went from the back alley to Main Street with little or no restrictions or protections. Many of the independent abortion facilities are less regulated than your local nail salon or hair salon. The fact that they have to, quote unquote, work on their messaging shows that we are making a difference.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, weekday mornings from 8 to 10 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
Beacon Skin and Surgeries is a comprehensive dermatology center on the border of Troy and Rochester Hills, south of M59 and in Livonia.
Beacon Skin and Surgeries perform full skin exams and focus on the diagnosis and treatment of all types of skin cancer and precancerous lesions. All are board-certified dermatologists and fellowship-trained surgeons. Call 248-852-1900. Beacon Skin and Surgeries, a beacon for patient care. 248-852-1900.
Is your child struggling with math or reading? Want to boost their grades and confidence? Hi, this is Ed Bahura. Welcome to Sylvan Learning Centers, where success is just a session away. With 45 years of experience, Sylvan Learning offers help in reading, math, college prep, and much more, with flexible schedules, affordable rates, and interest-free financing. Enroll today and watch your child's confidence soar. Catch up, keep up, and get ahead. Call 1-800-EDUCATE.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Dr. David Andes, Catholic catechist, speaker, writer, living in Birmingham, Alabama. And most of you might know him as the host of EWTN's daily call-in radio program called To Communion. David, when we last left off, you were talking about being in a mixed marriage and inviting your bride to go to confession with this particular priest who was helpful to you. And she didn't take it very well, did she?
She did not take it well at all. And but I had this really strong intuition that it was a good idea. And so I kept asking her. And, of course, it made her really upset. And she got very irritated at me. And eventually she said, don't ask me again. And I said, okay, but would you just go see Father Angelus for confession? You know, I wasn't going to take no. And she finally said, look, if you will lay off and promise to never ask me again, I'll go once. And I figured that was as good as I was going to get, so I said, okay. Mm-hmm. So she went once. And then she went twice. And then she went three times. And then she was going every week. And then she started praying the rosary. And then she started going to Mass. And she started to practice the faith. And then, a couple of years in, maybe a year in, she said, I want us to have our marriage convalidated. Which, when we got married initially, for reasons that are too complicated to go into, the priest that received me in the church told us we didn't need to have our marriage convalidated. And there was actually an ambiguity in the 1983 Code of Canon Law that has since been resolved that made that question somewhat ambiguous. It's no longer ambiguous, but it was then. But in any event, so she said, I want to have our marriage convalidated. And we did. We did. And both of us actually found that kind of a bittersweet moment. Because unlike when we were 21, we were jaded by this time. And there was no illusion of some sort of romantic ideal about what marriage life was like. We both knew it was hard. And we knew to make the decision to stay together, which we considered to be the right thing to do because we had children, we had family, necessarily entailed a lot of sacrifice. And someone asked my wife one time, why did you decide to have your marriage convalidated with David? And she said, because I decided to suffer. And they laughed. They thought she was joking, but she was dead serious.
Yeah.
You know, so neither one of us knew whether, had no concept that things would get miraculously better if we did that. It just seemed like the appropriate moral decision. And so we did. And then beyond all expectations, things began to change. And they got better, and they got a lot better. And I wrote a friend of mine, who's still one of my best friends, and who knew what kind of pain I was in. And I said to him, I'm living in a state of marital bliss. And he said, I can tell, it's obvious. And he'd lived through the former. And then it wasn't too long after that. We had four kids at that point. Then my wife turned to me and said, we need to have another child. We need to have a child of our Catholic conversion. We need to have a child of our Catholic faith. And so we conceived our fifth child, and that was his name is Joseph Benedict. Double name, named after Joseph Ratzinger / Benedict XVI, who was Pope at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, since then, can I tell you that bliss has remained the uninterrupted state of my consciousness since then? No, I can't. And in fact, we've had some really, really tragic things happen to us.
Mm.
But they weren't the tragic things that happened to us when we were, you know, 24, 25, because they weren't born out of this particular marital wound. You know, they were born out of other circumstances in our life.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got into Catholic media and EWTN approached me about writing a book, I went to my wife and spoke to her about it. She said, "You need to write a book about our marriage." And so that's why I wrote the book, The Catholic Church Saved My Marriage, because mm-hmm. It did. And, you know, there were several things. I mean, one, the church's teaching about marriage as a vocation.
Yeah.
The church's teaching about the role of the sacraments. The church's teaching about the purpose and ends of human sexuality. The church's teaching about the nature of virtue and human flourishing.
Yes.
The means of grace, the habits of life, the examples to acquire those virtues. All of that made a tremendous difference, you know, and honestly, like, the celibacy of priests and the celibacy of Christian religious and the chastity was a tremendous help to me in living my marital vows.
Mm.
And, you know, people, non-Catholics will sometimes criticize priests. And say, what can they possibly say to me about my marriage? They're not married. I found that not to be the case at all. And I actually thought that, you know, here are people who've made a sacrifice. They've sacrificed their sexuality to serve the common good of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually began, and they're not in books. You know, my wife once accused me. She said, "You write about the Catholic faith in books, but it's not like that on the ground." These guys were not in books. They were in my life. They were in my home. They were at my dinner table.
Yeah.
And there they were, you know, in their little brown robes or whatever they were wearing, or their clericals, or their habits. And I could see in front of my face someone who had sacrificed their sexuality for the sake of a greater good, for the common good, for something other than themselves. I found that to be tremendously valuable to me, and still do. So there it is in a nutshell, Marcus.
I've read the book, and it still moves me to hear you share this. And there's so much. You and I share a lot in common in terms of the. I guess we share similar thought processes. And frankly, becoming Catholic and learning about the mechanics of grace. Sorry, that's a technical way to say it, but learning of how grace works in the soul, and so elevation in the life of virtue, so much so that I'm not once saved, always saved, but I was saved, I am saved, and I'm continually going to be saved by the grace of God, and that my marriage can be that sacramental vehicle, so to speak, of my ongoing sanctification, and that my role is to sanctify my bride. I never had that as a Protestant. And so it was the Catholic faith that gave me the blueprint necessary to understand my real role as a husband to my darling bride. And by the way, again, just to share how much we have in common, my firstborn son's name is Benedict Joseph for very similar reasons.
Yeah. I love it.
So yeah, just share about that outside of the Catholic sphere, you really, really don't get that kind of doctrinal expansiveness and richness that gives marriage its truest meaning.
No, you're absolutely right, and I want to speak with sensitivity and discretion here, mm-hmm. but I want to touch on a topic related to that. So when I was a Protestant, I was taught you don't divorce your wife under any circumstance, and you know, you don't have sexual relations outside of marriage,
mm-hmm.
Those are absolute no-nos. But inside of marriage, there are kind of no rules.
Mm.
And in fact, there's a very well-known Protestant ministry run by a prominent writer and psychologist that is known to give family life, marriage life, parenting advice. And it's, you know, it's a household name. And if I said it, you probably know what I'm talking
about. Yes, yes.
Right? And it functions, at least it used to, you know, 20 years ago. I don't know if it still does. It functioned as a kind of quasi-magisterium for Protestants when it came to questions of moral theology.
Yep.
You know, what should I do about X? Well, let's see what so-and-so says. And that would be the way it would go, right? And, you know, if you would consult that resource for advice on marriage and marital sexuality, let's just put it this way. They gave diametrically opposite advice to Catholics. And you know, they would agree on, you know, you can't have sex outside of marriage. But on everything else, the ethic that I found there was essentially the ethic of the world.
Right.
That it's kind of whatever floats your boat, you know, it's there for your pleasure and aggrandizement. And it's ultimately disconnected from human procreation, from the bearing of children.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the Catholic thing, Catholic view, is that the whole institution of marriage and all of its intrinsic parts and activities are ordered to an end beyond the self.
Yes.
Namely, this community of the family that is created through the sexual act. You know, it all culminates in the creation of that community of the family, for which you then sacrifice your personal pleasure. And so the whole ethos of Catholic sacramental theology of marriage is utterly different from the ethos that I lived as a Protestant. I'm very Protestant.
David, thank you very much for making the time to speak with us. Always enjoy these
Absolutely.
Occasions. My guest, Dr. David And, is Catholic catechist, speaker, writer. We've been talking about how the Catholic Church, its teachings, saved his marital life, and how the theology of marriage in the Catholic Church is so beautifully expansive. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.